Hello, welcome to the New Stack Makers, a podcast where we talk about at-scale application development, deployment, and management. Hey, all. Welcome to another episode of the New Stack Makers. And today our guest is Chris DiBona, Director, Open Source. We're talking about the state of open source at Google. And I'd love to ask people on our show about their earliest memories of working with computers. And I'm curious about yours. What are those earliest memories you have? And what impact did it have on you and still does today?
Well, so the first computer I ever messed around with, my dad was working for a company called Terratech. And they were a drilling core engineering firm, which means they take these really long segments of rock out of the ground, these cores, and then they analyze them, and then they tell people how to drill, you know, that kind of thing. And so they had this huge lab, just like a science fiction lab, like covered in, you know, hydraulics and all this stuff. And they had a computer, an HP 85. It was a glorified calculator, but it had a printer. And he's like, hey, you should check this out. And so he brought it home for a couple of weekends. You know, and I just messed around with it, and it was super fun. And when I'd visit him at work, I would mess around with that computer. And then my mom, who was a real estate agent, they ended up getting an IBM PC about a year or so later, so she could do the MLS work. Ah. And so I basically claimed it as my own, and she's like, you know, I have to do some work. And I'm like, oh. And that was sort of the start of it. And it was the kind of thing where, you know, the original IBM PC came with these manuals, these three-ring binders. With BASIC and DOS and all the rest. And I basically memorized them.
Wow.
You know, it was because I was reading, you know, basically like a book a day practically back then. And when I saw that, I was like, oh my gosh, this is everything.
You want to read it all.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, that was the beginning. That's the root of the tree.
How does that impact you today?
You know, it's funny because I was having this discussion with Ben Jackson, who's in charge of cloud developer relations, but he's sort of a famous documentarian, you know, for code and, you know, and docs and the rest. And it's just, I've always had this is going to sound a little weird. 20 years ago, whatever it was, you know, PHP.net was out there, and it was basically the closest thing to that old binder. But at the bottom of every page, every documented keyword, function, you know, language thing, there was this discussion board, right? And it was all these people saying, oh, yeah, I'm using PHP. This is like PHP a long time ago. I'm using PHP on this platform, this operating system, this web server, and it's not working like that, right? Why isn't it working? And then someone else would chime in, oh, that's because you're on that, so you need to do this. And it was like this incredible community of developers. People always poop on PHP, but what they don't realize is everyone was so there for each other to help them express themselves on the web so quickly. There was no gatekeeping, there was no rejection, and it was just like everyone was just trying to help everybody do a nice job. And so PHP grew incredibly fast, right? And like the other developers of the other languages were like, well, you know, PHP, it's so sloppy or whatever they'd say. But the thing was, they were sloppy, but sure, okay. But they were shipping and it was incredible, right? So I always like, you know, I just want PHP.net for everything, every language, every tool, everything, where there's this community of people talking. And you see some of that on Stack Overflow. You see some of that in some of these other sites. And you saw some of that come up in places like GitHub. But I was always like, you know, we need to be able to synthesize, get these people talking to each other. And us talking to them with our developer advocates and really pull everyone along on this train. So I have a lot to say about documentation. It's not super well informed, but I was always really inspired by those early PHP developers. You know, they were really an incredibly welcoming community, like diametrically opposed to the Perl community at the time, which was very just like a borderline abusive, frankly.
Gosh, what's the difference between those communities? I mean, we see differences in communities all the time, but what were the differences there?
Well, I mean, so back then, so it's funny because everyone's on Slack now, right? But back then, everyone was on IRC, on Freenode, right. and the rest. And the PHP channels versus the Pearl channels were night and day. Pearl channels, if you came in and asked a fairly common question, you would end up, you know, being kicked out of the channel, you know, by Randall Schwartz or somebody, Tom Christensen. And then you go to the same communities on the same IRC servers for PHP or for some other languages. And they'd be like, oh, no, yeah, it's just, you know, go here. We have a FAQ. Oh, you're obviously doing homework. That's okay. Go check out this page here. And it was a whole different approach than Pound Pearl. Back in IRC, the channels were hashtag channel name. Right. So it's funny because like as we grew different developer communities at Google, it was really interesting to watch how they adapted to interacting with the community when they did. You know, not everyone does. And try to help them, try to guide them when we could, you know.
Around that time, open source was emerging to some extent, or it had already had emerged, just thinking 2000, what year was that? Late 90s, early 2000s?
So the meeting was in 1998, and it was Christine Peterson, Larry Augustin, Tim O'Reilly, and a bunch of other folks at our, I worked for a company called VA Linux at the time. And we had this meeting, and we basically talked about free software. We talked about the new generation of licenses that were coming out, like the Apache license and the rest. And Christine Peterson suggested that we call it open source software to delineate it and to sort of be an umbrella term for all these style of licenses based largely on the open source definition, which was based on the Debian Free Software Guide. So I'm going into history here. Long short of it is, yeah, so it was about 98, and these communities were extremely active, you know, starting even years before that. So, yeah.
And there's a story about why open source wasn't hyphenated. What is that story?
You know, I actually didn't delve into that very much. There was a question of why it wasn't open source trademark, and why did they choose a term that was hard to trademark at the time? I believe in talking to Christine Peterson about it, you know, they were pretty inspired by the term open source intelligence, which in the, you know, security community, you know, they call that when they collect, you know, the newspapers, they watch the TV, they listen to the radio, and they try to derive information that isn't otherwise public from those open sources. And so that was sort of like, okay, you know, this is basically open source software. Right. So you can derive value from this publicly available software, and you're also protected from people expecting warranty or indemnification as part of your sharing. You know, so, you know, people talk about like, oh, you have to capitalize this, you have to hyphen that. And then they rapidly become like GIF versus GIF. And I'm just like, you know, these actually aren't real issues.
These are the big issues that rule the day.
You know, it's like when I think about like, you know, I don't want to talk about lawsuits, but when I think about people who have sued in the open source milieu, the apostrophe never comes up. The dash never comes up. It's always about something else, you know.
No, I just remember hearing it once and I couldn't remember. But, you know, so you've been at Google since early 2000s, right?
Yeah, well, 2004. Yeah.
2004. Yeah. And were you managing the open source group at that time?
So the story of my coming into Google is actually pretty funny. So Larry and Sergey told their favorite recruiter, Carrie, to go and find an open source person. We're big enough, what we need are an open source person now, is what they said. And she's like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, what is that even, right? So she reached out to some sort of open source nerds, free software nerds in the company, and said, what do you think that they want? And they're like, well, maybe they want this, maybe they want this. So they started interviewing a bunch of people. This was actually in late 2003 when they asked her to go and find somebody. And then I had left VA Linux, which had become SourceForge, which had become all these other names. And it's where /.SourceForge and a bunch of other open source oriented sites were based for a long time. And then I had done a game company, and it was terrible. I did a terrible job. Let's be clear. And so that game company failed. And then I was just doing some consulting around Linux. For the Gap and for others. And I went to a lunch, and one of those open source nerds that Carrie had asked, you know, said to me, hey, you know, we're looking to hire maybe you, Chris. I'm like, why? I mean, you guys are a search engine. What do you care about a guy like me? He's like, nah, just come interview. I'm like, all right, fine. So I go in and I interview, and I had actually offers from other firms because I was starting to look for a full-time job again. And then they hired me, you know, and then I remember my first meeting with my boss. So my boss is Wayne Rosing, who was this legend. He was in charge of like the Apple Mac development from like the Apple II through the first Macs. And he said, you know what? You don't work for me. You work for Bill Koren. I'm like, oh, okay. So I go over to Bill Koren's office, and Bill Koren used to run Bell Labs. That's where Rob Pike and all those guys work. And he's like, hey, you're the open source person. I'm like, yeah, that's right. Great to be here, Bill. And, you know, and he's like, good, go open source person stuff. And I'm like, you have no idea what I do for a living, do you? He's like, nope, not at all. But I will tell you, I know you were hired for a reason. So go do that. And I'll let you know if you screw up. And if you need anything, just find me. And I'll see if I can help. I'm like, okay. And so I was shown to my desk, which was sort of in this corner between a girder and two cubes. One was the blogger team. One was HR.
Oh, nice.
Which is how I got to know a lot of really great people in both teams, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, was he playing a joke on me or was he serious? And I figured, you know what? He was probably serious. He's a serious guy. I'm going to go do what he said. So I went out and I did my open source thing. The first thing I did is I checked out the compliance posture of the company. And then tweaked and shifted and put up some guardrails where I needed to. And then I looked into how to release software and make it more of a mechanism than an exception, right? You know, how to keep the patches flowing from our very driven engineering community into the world of open source software. And that was when we stood up our first developer relations site because we didn't have one. And so I stuck one up and it was called codeduckwill.com. And we released our first projects there. We released, I think, 4 projects about 5 months after I started. Hmm. And now we release about 4 or 5 projects a day. So it's been a very well-oiled machine during my tenure. So I'm really lucky to have been here.
What's changed? What's remained the same?
So everything has changed. So anyone who tells you that Google today either has to be or is like the Google of 2004 either is in such a privileged position or they don't know what they're talking about. So everything has changed. So the scope of the company, the scrutiny of the company, the coverage of the company, the number of engineers has multiplied. So when I started, we had 900 engineers in the company, and now we're a lot more than that, you know? At the time, you know, it was funny. I think we had 4 buildings that we had just purchased in 2004, and those were mm-hmm. the old SGI buildings. And then we had leased a bunch of ones from the Sun and Remedy and these other companies that had moved out of that area. And then now our real estate portfolio is insane.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. So it's like, it's an extremely different place. And it's, you know, I sort of pride myself, and I wonder how long I'll last with this statement, but I pride myself in saying every couple of years, okay, what is the person that Google needs today, that Alphabet needs today, that if I were new, that I would want to do and would be most appropriate for the modern Google of today. And so far, I guess it's worked, you know. I'm sure there are other people who would say or could do better, but I'm pretty happy with how I've adjusted with my team, which is really big from my perspective. When I started, it was just me. Now I've got a team of, I don't know, almost 50 people working on various aspects of open source release support and outreach. And it's very rewarding.
So the change has come with growth. It's come with kind of the scope of the company.
Yep.
And how has that affected the approach to open source and how you view it?
So I used to think that there was an ideal singular approach to open source. And what I've sort of come to peace with by being at Google is that we don't have one approach. We have every approach to open source software release community and the rest. And so I can point across the company at projects that are very, you know, insular and researchy and are really in support of, say, a publication or a data set, right? And then there are others that, you know, they're posting weekly minutes online. They're, you know, every patch, like for instance, Fuchsia, The first time the press and the outside world noticed it was actually 6 months after the first patch hit GitHub, and it was never on internal resources back then. And so, you know, so we have the whole spectrum of every project style, every project management style that you might want, need, or despise, you know. And so accommodating the needs of the business across all the product areas, all the alphabet entities, is always going to be imperfect, but it's what we strive for. So, and I know that sounds like it's really high level, you know, so I'd love to drill down on whatever you like. It's just, when you look at a company, the scope and scale of Google with our perspective on trying to release information, it's always really, it's going to be multivariate and multifaceted.
What clicked for Larry, you know, with open source? He's a technologist, clearly.
Yeah.
And what kept things clicking over time? I mean, you started by the, you know, as you said, between the HR office and the blogger team.
You have to realize, and then SRE was like two cubes over. I mean, we weren't huge. It was funny because, and tell me if this is boring for you, but, you know, at the time, the four engineering buildings, you know, it's like you knew where all the teams were, you know, like, yeah. Jeff Dean and Sanjay, they were over in third floor of 42.
Yeah.
You know, Eric was on second floor of 42. Larry and Sergey had their new office built out in 43. So you're like, you know, everyone knows where everyone is, right? And everyone's sort of clumped in their little spots, you know, SRE, and then you had Blogger, then you had HR, and then you had recruiting, and then you had, you know, Ben Trainer's office, and then you had Bill's office. So I don't know why I'm rambling on about this. I mean, it was a really fun time, right? And you could literally walk over and you didn't want to interrupt someone while they were programming, but you could find people at lunch, you could find people at breakfast and really get to know their work. So for someone like me who is new to the company, right? So the company had been around for almost 5-6 years at that point, right? So there's a lot of established relationships and beefs, you know, between people. And then there's this new guy, hey, how's it going? Hey, can I help you release some software? You know, but they were, it was really fun. It was a fun time to be at the company because it was very easy to make connections and just help out, you know? So again, I don't know, that was not really your question, but so let's actually listen to you.
No, it's very interesting because you talk about kind of where the people were and how many more buildings there are now, and the role of open source continued to build momentum, you know,
yeah.
as the organization grew. So there's a real corollary there.
Yeah. It's funny because, you know, when I talk to people, they'd be like, I don't know, what's the story of open source? Why does it matter? And I'm like, oh, well, you know, it's just, it's for a long time, it was a force multiplier. It was, for every line of code a Googler would write, I had 10 or 20 that came from the outside world and were vitally important to us. It was this remarkable foundation to build on top of for a very, very long time. And then we're like, isn't open source the right way to change computer science, to change the industry, to introduce new platforms? And that was really exciting because I had done a lot of software release in the past before Google. And I was like, yeah, so if we want to do this, whether it was Chromium or Android or, you know, just, you know, changes to languages and then languages themselves like Go and Dart and the rest. It's like, yeah, I mean, why would you not use open source? Open source is absolutely the right way. And you can articulate your strategy, your business strategy through the licenses you choose, through the communities you choose to engage with or to develop or to extend. So, you know, and the thing is, a lot of people think that there has to be an oppositional posture. And sometimes that's absolutely there. Like we want to go in one direction. This other group wants to go in this direction. So we fork, you know. But for the most part, it's always been a very positive discussion, you know, where we were like, listen, open source is this great fertile medium for us to work with other people. So let's use it that way. And through that, I think we've been able to do some remarkable stuff and releases.
One example I find of interest is the Go programming language. And you mentioned Rob Pike.
I got to tell you. So Rob, this is when Rob was sitting in 43. He was in the same office as Dick Seitz, who was the creator of the Alpha, and Dave Prezzata, who is this Google legend. And Rob Pike, he's like, hey, you're the open source. I'm like, yeah. And he's like, so I'm Rob Pike. I'm like, everyone knows who you are, Rob. And he's like, bah, you know, I've been talking to Ken Thompson, you know, my old pal Ken, which is, you know, how it was, right? So he's like, so I was talking to Ken and talking to Dennis, And we think that it's time to do a new language. So this guy, Russ here, you know, he was our intern at Bell Labs, you know, Russ Cobb.
Yeah.
And so we're going to do this language. What do you think? And I was like, that sounds great. We should do a language. Let's ship a language, you know? And cause I was like, shipping a language with Rob Pike, that's the dream, you know? So, and I remember Bill Corin at the time saying, so we're going to release a language, huh? And that's kind of my imitation. and I'm like, yeah, no, we have to. I mean, it's Rob, it's Ken, it's Dennis. He's like, well, yeah, that's true. So, how should we staff it? I'm like, well, you know, you're gonna have Russ work on it. You'll have Robert Griesemer work on it. You'll have Rob working on it. And he's like, yeah, okay. Yeah. And then I made a joke and I don't think Bill thought it was that funny. So we had just transitioned from what we called Google 2, which was kind of not a great thing, to Google 3, which is the fundamental underpinnings for all of our services. You know, Borg, it was written in the Google 3 environment, Spanner, all these like search ads, all of them were written in Google 3. And so we were talking about what is Google 4, Google 5, what should those be? Should those epic changeovers happen? I was like, you know what you should do? You should make it so that Google 5, because Google 4 had already kind of not worked. Google 5 should just be go. And he's like, Chris, just no, it's not ready. No. And I was like, but come on. And this was like 2009. So, you know, it wasn't ready, but it's like being able to work on a new language from those people. Whenever I see Russ, I actually call him future Japan Prize winner, Russ Cox. You know, this is an incredible privilege to be able to work with these people. And so finding like when the cloud community really glommed on to Go, whether it was Docker and then Kubernetes and the rest, they were like, oh, Go's the way. And I'm like, yeah, it is, right? And it was just so great to watch like all the creative things that people built using Go. And I was like, this is exactly why we released it, because, you know, we felt the world needed this new language, right? And you're seeing the same kind of excitement around Rust. You're seeing the same kind of excitement around Go. And it's like, ah, this is a great time to be in computer science. I'm still excited by this stuff, you know?
Yeah, it was a real heyday then, you know, when I think it was around 2013, I went to the GopherCon show in Denver. Mm-hmm. And it was so lively, and so there was so much energy there. And it reminded me of some of the early days of the blogging conferences that you would go to, like and the fascination of the time with PubSub and RSS.
Sure.
And then it grew, and then you saw the emergence of some real personalities come out of that. You know, Rob was legendary already, but Kelsey Hightower, for example.
Sure.
I remember seeing him on stage at this, doing the keynote in Denver. I'm like, this guy's amazing. He's super knowledgeable and he's like really great on stage. And that really, I think, was such an interesting time, and it prompted so much in terms of what we see today, right? With Kubernetes and the rest. But, you know, and since that time, we've seen a real kind of growth in open source. I mean, a real big growth in open source. And I'm curious on how are you managing it now? Like, you know, Google, clearly, I mean, Google is Google, right?
Yep.
And it's, you're doing 4 to 5 projects, releasing 4 to 5 projects a day, but how do you just keep up with it all?
Well, it's worth pointing out of those 4 or 5, usually 3 are like API examples and that kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah.
So keeping up with it, one of the temptations when you're a regulator, which is kind of what I am, right, is that you end up putting up a lot of barriers to release, right? And in my experience, when you do that, you both alienate your engineering staff, you alienate the outside world, but you also make it really, really difficult when you're going to be really serious about a release to do it well.
Mm-hmm.
So our perspective has always been put the least possible amount of barriers to release, the least practical amount. And that's really tricky in a company our size, because we have real obligations to regulators all over the world. You know, we have mm-hmm. consent decrees. We have all this stuff where we have to basically promise that we're, and I should point out, this isn't an obligation. This is really important. Like, so for instance, there's the Buzz consent decree, which is 20 years long, right? And says that for the things that we release, we're going to be very careful about PII. We're going to be really careful about these other things. So when you create these systems for both intake and outflow of code, you have to really pay attention so that your engineers don't hurt the communities they're contributing to, that they don't hurt Google, and that they don't hurt themselves. And then for intake, you have to make it really efficient and really effective so that they'd rather do that than something else, right? Which isn't trackable, which isn't traceable, which isn't manageable, right? So it's funny because you mentioned a couple of projects you might ask about, and I don't want to be unsatisfying, but I see my job as making it easy for every project to release with the right licenses, with the right, frankly, legal coverage, so that they can release and be efficient in working with these outside communities. So the amount of control I have is often asynchronous. In the end, we have to have a Sarbanes-Oxley signatory on new project releases. And so I ended up being that. And so we try to basically give all the coverage, sort of the heat shield for these engineers so they can just engineer. So they can do the software engineering, they can do the release, and they know that they're protected from some of the bad outcomes. And the way we do that is we say, hey, listen, you go through this path. It's as fast and as efficient as we can make it. We're always tweaking it to become faster and more efficient. So it protects you, the communities you're going to work with, and the company. And so changing that over time has been a huge challenge, right? Because, you know, the side effect is when there is a legal question, you know, we have to be ready to answer it at a moment's notice, right? And be responsible to the internal and external consumers of our software. It's a big responsibility. And it's why my team has grown, because I couldn't possibly have done this myself. And so we've written a ton of scripts, a ton of management software, and we've open sourced a ton of it too, and tried to get tools like Fossology and the rest developed so that we can use them in our different processes. But it's a thorny problem. It's really hard to grow not being a gatekeeper beyond that which is your jurisdiction, your remit, so that you're not slowing down the other parts of the company. You're only giving them the support they need so they can launch quickly and safe. Anyways, I'm a bureaucrat, Alex. This is the thing a lot of people don't realize. I try to be the most efficient bureaucrat that I can ever be for Google, for my engineers, for my friends, so that they can just be great engineers and not worry about the sticky stuff, which I find fascinating, but I don't want my engineers to worry one second about buzz consent decree when they're releasing a project.
So what does that mean, I think, for open source overall and how you kind of view it today? Because I'm thinking about, you know, what you're saying you have to be thinking about Sarbanes-Oxley and compliance according to regulations all over the world. That's going to, at some point, touch a lot of other companies too out there who are, you know, we're going to need more software to run their companies, and increasingly it's going to be open source if it isn't already, right? I mean, we, you know, software's at the center of business and software's built on open source. And so that has some ramifications for the rest of the world, it seems like. And how do you think of that in context with Google's future in open source?
So the other side of this is I'm actually not the whole world's open source guy. I always want to help jurisdictions, other companies, customers of cloud. I'm always a very easy person to go talk to them. But Google is my problem. Alphabet is my problem. And by extension, because Google really takes advantage, not in a bad way, but we understand the resource that is open source. So we're really very much incentivized to ensure that open source continues to thrive in ways that I don't think a lot of people understand. So when I think about consumers of open source software, user developers, and people who adopt open source software and build their businesses on it, I think that it's something we have to be very, very careful with when we release software, when we improve software, that we're not alienating these communities without really thinking it through. So, because it's actually really easy to have a cavalier approach at releasing as much software as possible, so long as Google's protected, and you end up really changing markets. So I think that you should really think about what you're doing to a community when you release software. You know, and on the flip side of this is I don't necessarily think that you know, the feelings of a large commercial proprietary software company who may or may not be a competitor of Google's. We may or not even know they exist. I'm not as worried about them. I figure they can take care of themselves. But I do worry about the open source developer in the middle of, I don't know, Auckland, New Zealand, who's been working on some content management system for the last 10 years. You know, I want to help them. You know, I want to help them continue to thrive. So that we have programs around too. So, but yeah, sorry, I'm rambling a bit because it's like, you know, part of being effective at Google means that I can't always help or some issue in the middle of some place that doesn't really have a lot to do with us, you know.
I just think the experiences that you face are kind of a harbinger of things to come in some respects. I think that's true with scale out software companies overall.
So this is what's really, really interesting. So what you don't realize you're touching on, okay, is that shouldn't we have not unique, but prophetic insight into where Linux needs to go over the next 5 years, right? Because of our exposure to these very large scale problems and small scale problems, say on mobile and the rest, right? So one of the things I've been talking about for a number of years now is where does Linux need to be to continue to thrive in the data center, in the mobile space, even in places like automotive and the rest, right? So for instance, right now, everyone's been talking a lot about, you know, these farm memory allocation, where basically you think you're getting the memory on that same motherboard, but you're really getting it from a machine that all it does is host memory, right? Does the Linux kernel really support that? And does it support it in a way that's truly secure right now? Yes, you can do it, but there's some real changes that really need to be made, both to the hardware, the underlying hardware, as well as to the software of Linux, so you can continue to do that in an efficient and secure manner. Right? Because I don't know if you remember back in 2009, 2008, there was a technology out of Wisconsin. Like the X-Cray people had it, and it basically allowed you to memory map memory across the network using these very high-end interconnects. And so the host CPU had no knowledge of this memory mapping happening. And we're like, whoa, 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 whoa. That means those machines, you know, the memory can just be exfiltrated. Right. So we have to be very careful when and how we use technology like this. Otherwise, so we can't have it be, no user data can hit this. No logs can hit this. You know, maybe things like indexes from the crawlers could be, or, you know, that sort of thing. That isn't PII. That isn't possible to become PII. Right. So we had all these discussions about how to use technology like this. And, you know, before that, you know, there were some real concerns that Linux couldn't handle, like the, I think it was at the time, the Broadcom interconnects, the fabric interconnects for 10 gigabit network. And so we paid a company in Berkeley to write it and get it into the Linux kernel, because we actually didn't have the people at Google at the time who knew how to write to those Atheros or Broadcom chips and how to bring those to Linux. Because at the time, to be clear, we were looking at $1,000 a port costs for 10 gigabit networking. And so the only way to bring that down was to make sure that Linux supported it. So my question for you and for all of your listeners is, where does Linux need to be 5 years from now? Where do these languages need to be 5 years from now? Or is that too far out? Should I just be thinking about tomorrow, right? Like, where have we failed to anticipate where computer science and the industry is going so that we can make this software work, right? So, I mean, Kubernetes really was, you know, when I think about Tim Hawk and the rest of the team, the reason they worked on Kubernetes is because they're like, people outside Google really need this. You know, we had had, you know, so I'm sure you've heard about Borg a million times. You've probably heard about the birth of Kubernetes a million times. What people don't talk about is the number of times we tried to rewrite Borg at Google and failed. We had, I can think of at least four times that we rewrote Borg. Sometimes we'd replace Borg with the new Borg. Sometimes we would write something and it would not work. And we're like, oh, we can't do this. And then Tim and the guys, they're like, well, you know, what if we make one that's really not suited to a million machines, right? But it's suited to what our customers are dealing with today and in the future, right? And that's what became Kubernetes and what resonated so well with people, because we had seen what was going on with Docker and it was so exciting, right? Like, man, imagine if we could use Docker at Google for deploying search or deploying ads, right? So we had all these discussions, and long and short of it was, it's like, you know, we had a burgeoning cloud sort of business, and we're like, you know, the cloud business really needs the ability to compete around orchestration and workload management. And so what's the right way to do that? And so then you've got Kubernetes, then you've got a lot of these cool tools.
It's interesting because you talk about all these things. And one of the things that's so clear to us is that we're only seeing the start of how the internet itself will be programmed, right?
Yeah.
You know, we're only on the verge of really true decentralization, you know, off the machines themselves and into the, you know, into the world. And that's to me an interesting kind of a thread, and where I'm curious about open source and its evolution, and we'll be interested to talk with you about it over the years ahead, because as we start to see more evolution of open source, you're going to start to see a lot of influences upon it, such as, you know, the number of people who are going to be needed to program it overall. Can't imagine you could be able to program the internet with the number of people who are doing it now. Just because there's just so much and it's just endless. And how do you think about compute, storage, and network on a node, be it a data center or, you know, a far off tower, you know, wherever it might be. And so that those are the kind of questions that are in my head. So I'm curious, and, you know, just maybe just in conclusion, any thoughts you have about those types of questions?
So it's funny. I knew I would probably do this at the end of this interview. And this is an area where I'm personally pretty weak, in my opinion. Because when I think about like edge computing on the internet, I still think about this sort of dense underlayment that is not what you're asking about at all. And so what I do when I get into these situations is I ping Eric Brewer, I ping Kelsey Hightower, and I say, is this really where people are going? I remember this was like 4 years ago. 4 years ago, I pinged, you know, 3 years ago, I pinged Kelsey about a thing, and I'm not going to say what it was, but I was like, people really program this way? Really? Really? He's like, actually, yeah, this thing here is really cool. And this thing, nobody cares about that, but this thing's really, and I was like, okay, thank goodness. So I'm going to say, go talk to them. Cause I, when I talk to them, I say, okay, where do we need to be as in the kernel, in the languages, in the system libraries, so that we can make what y'all are talking about actually happen and have those underlayments and foundations ready. Because I'll be frank with you, Alex, if you were counting on me to predict that, no way, that would be a very bad choice. So do what I do, talk to them, right? And the thing is, Eric and Kelsey both, they have so much respect inside this organization. They're like 201, if you talk to a Googler, it's kind of like the old days of Rob and Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie walking around. You're like, oh, okay, whatever they want to do, that's probably the right thing to do. And so I go to them and I say, guys, what are we doing right here? What are we doing wrong, you know?
So do you think open source needs to be a little bit easier for the people who are kind of moving into this world, or is it just pretty easy as it is and the experience is fine? I mean, there's probably so many different sides to that conversation, but is open source going to need to evolve to be, you know, more accessible and organizationally so as well, especially as we start, you know, seeing people of all different, you know, all different backgrounds come into the space?
Long time ago, I used to joke and say, who do you think is a programmer? Right? Because back then, this is when Visual Basic Pro had 3 million active developers. And I was like, that seems like programming to me. What was it about that environment that was so compelling for those people who did not consider themselves programmers to become, from what every perspective looks like programmers, right? And so what I'd say to you is, and you were in the audience when Linus was talking to Dirk. Mm-hmm. And remember what Linus said, he's like, getting people who both want to and understand what it means to work in C on a kernel is extremely difficult. These people are not getting replaced. They're basically getting replaced as quickly as they're dying.
Yeah.
Right. And so we have to move to Rust for device drivers. We have to have a better way of doing software development above the kernel so that we can continue to bring people to the level of which they're optimized and comfortable. Right. And I think this is really true. I think that like when you talk about edge computing, I see it as a response to how very difficult it is to do things underneath it, right? Building a scalable application in modern cloud architecture is very, very difficult. And so welcoming new people into that milieu is very difficult. So what can we do, right? So we have these serverless approaches that are very exciting. And the ones that are more accessible to the end user developer at companies or whatever, I think those are the ones that are going to succeed. It's so funny because everyone talks about Heroku, but what they miss is how easy it was to onboard a completely neophyte programmer to Heroku's semantics for cloud. And I know that Heroku stuff doesn't always scale and there's all these challenges and all the rest. It's the same things we said about Ruby on Rails. Like, oh, Ruby on Rails is great until you need to update. And it's like, yeah, but what you're missing is most people were pleased to learn because they could get there so damn fast, right? And the people who didn't notice why people loved it was because they could become productive. They could become productive for their users, their managers, their customers, like overnight. And it was incredibly refreshing. And people who weren't programmers before became Ruby on Rails developers remarkably fast. And so I think that, you know, as you say, okay, where are we failing, frankly, to welcome new developers? And where can we find the kinds of tools that they're going to be able to onboard onto and become productive quickly for themselves, their use cases and their users' use cases? And that's where I think you're going to see the most excitement and most growth, right? So anyway, I know I'm ranting here, but it's like, it's always amazing to me. It's like, sometimes I feel like people want to make things so hard as a business opportunity. And I'm like, there's an incredible business opportunity in making that onboarding productive and easy. So
I love this conversation, Chris. And I want to thank you so much for coming on to our show.
I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks for listening. Subscribe on Simplecast to listen to more episodes on the New Stack Makers. Create and share your favorite audiogram using our Simplecast player. For more articles and great stories, go to thenewstack.io.